Well, hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Tamwell Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book The Search for Captain Slocum by Walter Magnus Teller. We're on chapter 18, and this is the 13th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner to help support the podcast, or you can check out the Mariner podcast with all things sailing and seamanship each week, or of course, the Mariner YouTube channel, where you can see gear reviews, how-to videos, and me engaged in expeditions and projects all over the world. Now on with the story. Chapter 18. To be taken into account were some years of schooling where I studied with diligence Neptune's laws. Slocum wrote Sailing Alone Around the World in 1899. It was published in monthly instalments with illustrations in the Century Illustrated Monthly Magazine from September 1899 through March 1900. Having undertaken to write his story, the captain, with Hetty, left New York to return to East Boston. In an undistinguished neighbourhood, they doubled up with one of Hetty's sisters. Poor Hetty, what a life she lived! After 12 years of marriage, she still had no home. On the 30th of January, the captain wrote C.C. Bull. This is to report the Spray, my typewriter, and I are working along around Cape Horn now and will soon have some work ready to submit. Meanwhile, the show goes on. I am coming to New York tonight for a week on the Spray. It is likely that a cruise in northern waters in midwinter seemed preferable to Slocum, to a house and stove shared with the in-laws. By the end of April, he had to find another place to work and so sailed to New York, where Mabel lived. He did not go, like Melville, to a hotel room to finish his book. Instead, he sat in the cabin where, 5 years before, he had written Voyage of the Destroyer. Only this time, the Spray was tied up at Erie Basin Dry Docks, Red Hook, South Brooklyn. Magazine work, as you know, is entirely new to me, the great Century being the first I ever tackled, he wrote to his editors. Nevertheless, the work went on schedule. His method was to know what I know before I go ahead. The sentences which gave him the most satisfaction were the ones that just fell into place when I knew my subject, as I know the tides in the Bay of Fundy. But if facility sometimes lagged, he had tenacity and discipline to fall back on. He had encouragement too. Mabel liked what he wrote. She compared his writing with Defoe's. It was she who first read the manuscript of the voyage, the captain wrote in her copy of Sailing Alone, but whether she read it when finished or while in progress and where is not known. The captain delivered his manuscript in early summer, then sailed for Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. Considerable revising remained to be done, but his publishers seemed to understand that even a literary sailor will sit in port just so long. At Cottage City on Martha's Vineyard, which he found a charming place, he read the first batch of proof. From there, 28th July, he wrote, I think I may be able to give the matter for the book many a touch which shall, when all will have been done, make it not the worst marine story in the world. I am most anxious to see a clear story appear in both magazine and book with no superfluous matter. But I find I must come to anchor and make a business of it if I hope to revise intelligently at all. Be patient with me still. And a few days later, I am glad that my poor manuscript fell into good hands. In the Century, it will appear far different to the 10 fathoms of autograph which I first submitted to Mr. Bull. How patient Century editors have been. I appreciate every touch of the pen given to my poor story. Mr. Johnson knows that I value also his exceedingly nice way of paying an old sailor a high compliment. Altogether, and best of all, I see my ship coming in under full sail, freighted to the load line. Editor and author worked harmoniously together. The captain took no extraordinary pains in his answers to publishers' questions, but scribbled his replies on the letter received. August the 8th, 1899. Dear Captain Slocum, when you shortened the rig of the Spray in Buenos Aires, did you take in a topmast or did you shorten the mast? Topmast was taken down at Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. Shortened mast 7 feet, bowsprit 5 feet at Buenos Aires. Yes. At the same time you shortened the bowsprit, did you also shorten the boom and to what extent? Shortened the boom inboard 4 feet at Pernambuco, shortened the outboard 4 feet at Port Angosto. At Port Angosto you put on the jigger, did you shorten the boom again so as to bring it inboard? Yes, at the outer end. And did you then put on the stern brace to support the jigger? No. If the circular brace was put there earlier, when and where and why was it added to the spray? Put on stern bracket at Rio to be ready for the mast. In the enclosed picture, the encounter with the great wave, the brace is shown. It was there then, and the boom is as short as when she was yaw rigged. It should be 4 feet over the stern. Isn't this all a mistake? When you see an error in a picture, we want you to speak up and speak out loud. It was a pleasure to get your letter this morning. Yours truly, signed C.C. Boole, assistant editor. Oddly enough, Mr. Boole, I was just rounding off some swearing about the Northern Light picture when your letter was handed to me. Slocum also sent an undated letter written between the 8th and 12th of August in which he enlarged on some of his replies. I should have mentioned that the jiggermast which I shipped at Port Angosto was taken on board while at St. Mary's Bay, where I found it among driftwood on the beach. It was one of those hardy spruce saplings. The boom projected over the stern till the jiggermast was stepped sufficient of the outer end and then sawed off to allow it to swing clear. This same boom was previously broken in the gale off the coast of Morocco and was fished then near the mainmast. The short end was removed at Pernambuco and the jaws refitted. This brought the boom in about 4 feet, but left some 4 feet still projecting over the stern until she was refitted, as before stated, at Port Angosto. It seems difficult, almost impossible, to get marine pictures done nearly right. The ship, NL, is made too stiff and is hogged. Her stern droops, but in the degenerate state of our marine, these matters have been overlooked. The man who revives interest will deserve our prayers. If Editor Boole was something of a sailor, one gathers that Editor Johnson was not. Robert Underwood Johnson, in the captain's words, slaughtered judiciously and liberally. His interest was in sharpening the narrative, while Boole pointed up the sailing. If at times Slocum's words rolled on in an almost compulsive talkativeness, in the use of nautical terms he shows nice restraint. The relationship between him and his editors seems to have been just right. So long as he was working, Slocum was reasonably happy. He found association with literary men one of the pleasures of life. Though work was still to be done on the book, it was summer in New England, and Slocum was sailing. His publishers patiently corresponded with him here and there. From Fairhaven, the 14th of August, he wrote Johnson, "I find it rather difficult to condense the variety of experiences while sailing free over the smooth sea from Good Hope. It was all ripple, ripple. However, the editor will know how to slaughter my pet so as to keep the matter down to at least 5 instalments. But it is, as a rule, at Lloyd's, that one cannot have too much of a good thing." In Fairhaven, Mabel was on his mind. He wrote Boole about her. He had asked her to write a preface to his story, which she did. He recommended her to the Century editors as a good writer, clever and strong, but they had rejected her contribution. "The dear lady is broken-hearted," Slocum explained to Boole. He added a joke that was perhaps not all joking. "I feel very sure that Mr. Boole will get me out of the difficulty. May I suggest, without being officious, that our really gifted friend write a story of adventure? I'll go to Iceland or the North Pole if no other subject can be found to write about, and be glad of the chance." A few days later, from Onset, Massachusetts, he wrote Boole a slightly incoherent letter complaining that mail and proof were not being forwarded promptly, as though publishers and postmasters were used to the ways of a sailor. "From the empty clamshells of a watering place, one can expect no better than I got at Cottage City," he commented. "Hetty is with him on the spray. Their address, till further notice, will be care of Postmaster, Fairhaven." But by October, Captain Joshua and Hetty were back in East Boston, this time moving over to another of Hetty's married sisters. When the third installment of Sailing Alone appeared, he wrote Boole, "I am very proud of the company the spray is in. Mark Twain's contribution in November Century is the best thing he has ever done in his long life of good work." Not many would agree with that judgment, but my debut as a literary person had a special appeal for Slocum. The piece told how Clemens, when a young journalist, journalism had attracted Slocum too, had covered in 1866 the burning of the clipper ship Hornet. Slocum probably remembered the incident. Clemens was in Honolulu when the 15 lean and ghostly survivors arrived after a voyage of 43 days in an open boat through the blazing tropics on 10 days' ration of food. A very remarkable trip, but it was conducted by a captain who was a remarkable man. He was a New Englander of the best seagoing stock of the old capable times, Captain Josiah Mitchell. Clemens was first with the news. His story of the disaster in the Sacramento Union launched him, he claimed, as a literary person. As one contemplates Captain Slocum in the role of writer, it is interesting to recall that Mark Twain considered his experience as a riverboat pilot the most important discipline of his life. Once again, life with in-laws was not a success. Within a month, the homeless ex-merchantman was back in New York. He took a room at the old Hotel United States, which stood near the East River waterfront on Fulton Street between Water and Pearl, within a short walk of the pier where the Northern Light had docked years before. From there, he wrote Bull. I have to report the most beautiful neuralgia experienced since Australia. I sent for Garfield to buy all the tea. He is in charge, but if this thing keeps on in my bones, I'll leave town. Can't help it. He did not leave, but stayed to joust with the writer of the column Topics of the Times. The New York Times had let his voyage go unnoticed, but as the account of the voyage appeared month by month, the columnist, at least, was impressed. What beat him was not that one man alone should circumnavigate the earth in a sailing boat of his own construction, or that afterwards he should tell his story so well, but that he should have sailed in the manner he said he did. Could he really have lashed the helm and slept? Could the spray have steered herself, so to speak? Cautiously, the columnist got underway. Interesting as undoubtedly are the articles in which Captain Joshua Slocum is telling of his voyage, there is lacking from them one thing, the absence of which is a sore trial to the temper and a somewhat severe trial to the credulity of all of us who have or pretend a knowledge of matters nautical. Captain Slocum repeatedly asserts that the spray was so rigged that she both could and would steer herself, or, to paraphrase his statements more explicitly, that he could so arrange his sails and so lash his rudder that his boat would keep on her course all night while her captain slept quietly in his cabin. The tale is painfully hard to believe. We won't say that the captain has been treating the truth with irreverence, or even that he is honestly mistaken as to the spray's intelligence. We will keep within a safe regret that he didn't reveal how the apparent miracle was performed. Queer things have been and will be done at sea. Slocum, the day after reading the above, sent in his reply. On the 11th of November, The Times published it, datelined The Sloop Spray. I am honoured by a criticism from an old salt. It is possible that things occurred on the voyage of the Spray inexplicable to some mariners, even of vast experience, and I can only regret not having met them before the articles were written, so that I might have taken them on a sail in the Spray to demonstrate her prowess. As the matter stands, it is now out of my power to further elucidate. This unpretentious sloop, built by one pair of hands after circumnavigating the globe, is sound and snug and tight. She does not leak a drop. This would be called a great story by some. Nevertheless, it is a hard fact. The story of the voyage is constructed on the same seaworthy lines. That is, it remains waterproof, which your navigating officer will discover, I trust, if only he exercised to the end that patience necessary on a voyage around the world. Came the rebuttal. The columnist said he was ready to believe almost anything about a ship or a boat, but belief and readiness to believe are not quite equivalent, and unfortunately, Captain Slocum is not in a demonstrative or explanatory mood. He had consulted a contemporary writer of sea stories, long since forgotten, who said that he never knew of but one vessel that had the reputation of steering herself, and that was the whaler Edward Everett. When on the Galapagos grounds, he had been warned to keep a sharp lookout for the Everett, as in all probability she would have no one at her wheel. Whether this reputation was deserved or not is beyond my knowledge, wrote the columnist. What with a reeking whaler dragged into the discussion and compared to the tight little spray, Slocum did not bother to reply further. Not much love was ever lost between merchantmen and whalemen or their respective followers, but this sort of criticism, which he had experienced nowhere else in the world, hurt the ego of the unemployed master mariner. The Times' last word on the subject was not spoken till the 6th of March 1900, after the final instalment of Sailing Alone had appeared. A note at the end of Captain Joshua Slocum's narrative promised, or seemed to promise, a supplementary article explaining how the captain taught the spray the difficult art of steering herself, That he really had accomplished this marvellous educational feat was asserted many times. Captain Slocum declares that he sailed from Thursday Island to the Keeling Cocos, 2,700 miles, in 23 days, and in all that time stood at the wheel not more than an hour. We have no inclination to question the accuracy of his figures, but, even with the most favourable conditions of wind and sea, did the Spray, when left to her own devices, constantly keep on her course, as that phrase is commonly understood, or did she reach her destination along a zigzag path, falling off and coming up as her headsails and those aft alternately got the better of each other? If the latter suggestion is true, how much simpler the captain's explanation might have been made. An astonishing suggestion, as though one could sail around the world alternately falling off and coming up. But in yachting circles, the Spray became, and remains to this day, a controversial subject. Perhaps the genius of the man who sailed her can no more be wholly explained away than the success of the voyage can be denied, but that the Spray, when properly set on her course, could, under various circumstances, hold it, unaided by a man at the wheel, was confirmed, as will be shown later by several friends who subsequently sailed with the captain. Slocum never invited on board those who challenged or criticised him. Clearly, he did not feel he had to prove anything. Though the Spray's steering qualities are no longer questioned, her model and rig are still discussed. There are those who think that Slocum succeeded, not because of the Spray, but in spite of her. A writer for one of the yachting magazines warned yachtsmen against building copies of the sloop. He called her the worst possible boat for anyone, and especially anyone lacking the experience and resourcefulness of Slocum, to take off soundings. The Spray has been compared to a Cape Cod catboat, and that means, as anyone who has sailed the latter knows, that while extremely stiff initially, if ever heeled beyond a critical point, she would flop over as inevitably as the platter which she resembled. But Slocum could not, if he had wished, chosen between a boat with comfortable broad decks and initial stability, and one specifically built for deep water, with less deck space but more of that final stability which rights a well-designed yacht even when knocked down with mast in the water. The Spray, a Delaware oysterman, was the only boat he had. L. Francis Herreshoff, son of the famous yacht designer, Captain Nathaniel Herreshoff, wrote, "My father did not think much of the Spray, but he had great admiration for Captain Slocum's ability to go around the world in such a poor vessel." Points such as these were appreciated later, when Slocum was dead, yet by and large he enjoyed a nice share of recognition. If it seems small compared with that given later to some who hustled through the air, it is partly because in the 19th century the uncommon personality was not yet an uncommon occurrence. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.